Afternoon. We are so happy to welcome you here today on this beautiful afternoon in this lovely and historic venue. I'm Marjorie Kay. I'm the book editor of the Christian Science Monitor. And on behalf of the whole Monitor staff, and particularly the Monitor's book section, I'm welcoming you. We have today a stellar panel here. We're delighted to be able to say we have Ha Jin, author of most recently a book, Boat Rocker, but perhaps best known for his 1990 book, The Waiting, which won award both the caused him to win both the National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award that year. We also have Grace Tallusson, who is the 2017 New Immigrant Prize Writing Winner awardee for her novel, The Body Papers. And then we have Marshan Kamali, thank you, who is the author of Tea and Together. She is a debut novelist and a playwright. And I will mention one attendee we don't have, unfortunately. You'll see in your programs the name Ilan Stavins. And Ilan is, as many of you will know, one of the best-known promoters of immigrant writing as an editor, publisher, and writer, and immigrant himself. But he unfortunately had a last-minute conflict and could not be here. However, I have to say we went from despair to elation when we were able to bring Marjan on the panel to substitute. We feel confident she has a very strong contribution to make today to what we have to say. I'd also like to introduce to you our moderator, my colleague, Simon Motlick. And Simon is a Boston-based writer for The Monitor. He specializes in writing on economic inequality and social mobility. He has also served The Monitor as a foreign correspondent in Bangkok, Beijing, and Jakarta. And before The Monitor, he wrote for Forbes and The Economist. Simon is originally from London, so he knows a thing or two about immigration as well. So anyway, as I said, we feel very confident this panel has a lot to offer. Some of you may have been at the BUR panel this morning, Strangers in a Strange Land. So again, also a panel on immigration literature. We are going to further that topic and perhaps take it in a few different directions. So I'm going to leave you now in the very capable hands of Simon and our excellent panelists.
Well, what a great panel. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm sure you are too. I'm going to try and take myself out of what I think will be a really fascinating dialogue here. I'm hoping that the writers will be speaking more than myself. But as Marjorie pointed out, I'm also an immigrant. I'm from Britain, which, you know, is the country that, if you look back, the very first wave of immigration that shaped America and shaped the imagination and shaped what writing could be, of course, came from Britain, and nowhere more than Boston is that the case. I was just thinking when I, you know, took on this panel that really, I mean, to a large degree, all American literature is the literature of immigrants, except for Native American writers. So, you know, the idea of the immigrant experience is baked into the formula of America. And these experiences are also different and subjective across time and space, and these are rich voices that bring us so much, which is why I'm very privileged to be talking to these particular writers, practitioners here today. You know, it's a time, of course, where immigration and the push and pull of America as this beacon for your tired, huddled masses, even the idea of that, the sanctity of that idea, it seems to be on our minds and seems to be in question. So I think the first question I want to ask my writers panel is, do you feel trapped at all by being presented as an immigrant writer, a writer of the immigrant experience, a hyphenated writer, or do you feel that you bring a clarity, an outsider's clarity to the experience and your voices? Julio Cortázar, the Argentinian writer, called it the feeling of not being quite there. Ha Jin.
Oh, you know, I came to, I went to Brandeis to do graduate work when I came to the States. So mentally, I was not prepared for immigration. But then later, 4 years later, Tiananmen Massacre happened, so I could not go back. And then, so at the time, I could be viewed as an exile. Still, sometimes, I think there, because in my case, there's a huge truncation severe transition between the present and the past, because I cannot go back to China. I've been here for 32 years. A larger part of my life spent in the States. At heart, I do accept myself as an immigrant. It's not for me. The matter is more important part is not to return. It is to arrive. So where to arrive, I'm not sure. But for me, maybe writing is one avenue to go to see how far I can continue. And also, but at the same time, I think return and arrival, they are not separated at all. We know in literature there is a beginning, there is the, in the beginning there is the end, right? The two are the same in a way. You know, it's a deeper kind of a return to arrive. Arrival and return are similar. So for me, I can accept, even at peace with my situation.
So Mardan, you were born in Tehran, but lived in a many different. Several different places, even before your family finally left Iran and moved to the West. So, how do you? And you have also written about being the hyphenated writer. So, how do you respond to this?
Actually, I was born in Turkey because my family kept moving, so I wasn't even born in Iran. But I consider myself Iranian American, and my family finally settled in the U.S. after. We were in Iran right after the 1979 revolution and the start of the war with Iraq. And I came here when I was 10, and I feel like I didn't choose to be an immigrant, but I'm always asked about being an immigrant. And my book is about an immigrant family from Iran who come and settle here in the U.S. I think personally, I always kept trying to find home. Even when we were moving, I kept trying to find home, and no matter what I did, I couldn't find it. I mean, for decades I tried. And then finally I realized, you know, maybe my home isn't a place. Maybe it's, I really found it more in reading, to be honest with you, and then later in writing. And the hyphenated thing is interesting because when I was growing up, you didn't hear the term Iranian American. I mean, we were a new sort of wave of immigrants, and most Iranian Americans came after the 1979 revolution. But then there's been waves since because things haven't gotten better. So I learned to not sort of pick one side of the hyphen, either or. I'm on the hyphen, and I feel like that's my place. And in fact, there was this tiny little passage in my novel that I wrote that I remember writing by hand when I was writing the first draft. And then I wanted to take it out because I thought, no one's going to like this. And that's the passage that's been quoted the most.
Could you read it for us? I think we have to hear it now,
okay,
don't we?
Okay, now we have to. Did you like the setup? Okay. So this is the passage that I almost took out, but now this it's everybody's favorite, or so they tell me. She knew how to swing her legs on that hyphen that defined and denied who she was, Iranian American. Neither the first word nor the second really belonged to her. Her place was on the hyphen, and on the hyphen she would stay, and on the hyphen she would sit, and on the hyphen she would stand, and soon, like a seasoned acrobat, she would balance there perfectly, never falling, never choosing either side over the other, content with walking that thin line.
So Grace, I think it's your turn on the tightrope on the hyphen now as Philippine, born in Manila, in
yes.
the Philippines,
yes.
And been here as a young girl, yeah. And so how do you grapple with the I mean you're a memoirist, you've written a series of essays. I should say that the book that you won the prize for hasn't come out yet, but it's a series of personal essays.
Yes, so my book, which will be out in fall 2018, is called The Body Papers. And it's, I take Well, it's about my experience as an immigrant and as growing up as a child immigrant. It wasn't my choice to come to this country. I came when I was 3 years old, but my memory really starts here. I don't know any other country but this one. And so when I found out, I think I was in high school, when I found out that we were actually undocumented, then it was really a shock. And I had to consider, it was a possibility that we could be deported, so I had to actually consider what that might be like if we went back to the Philippines, a place that I is a fantasy for me. It's an imagined place. I know it only through the little bits that'll come through the newspapers or the news at the time when I was growing up, or through stories, but otherwise it was a fantasy place for me. But I am happy to identify as an immigrant writer, as an Asian American writer, as a writer of color. I'm happy to take on all of those identities. Mm. We don't have enough literature from these communities, and I'm happy to do my work with it. Mm.
I should say we are going to open this up to questions later on in the session, but I have so much to ask these wonderful writers, so forgive me. Hajin, one of your books, A Map of Betrayal, was, spy fiction would be the categorization. I find it fascinating that you chose to write in that genre because, you know, the spy is always this sort of figure between these two worlds, which is sort of a bridge, and yet somehow becomes suspect by both sides. I mean, you know, John le Carré has obviously plumbed this in a kind of East-West Cold War sense. Could you talk a bit about why you decided to take that on, and as an immigrant writer, what do you feel about that genre? What it can teach us?
It was based upon a real figure, a major event. Larry Chen, but when I was a graduate student at Brandeis in the first year, he was caught as the top spy of the Chinese government. We all believe, he himself believed that the Chinese government would intervene and basically bring him back to China, but basically China denied any connection with him. He committed suicide in the prison. For me, this, in fact, also in the Chinese diaspora, a lot of people, even writers, try to write about this story. We didn't have enough information because the files were not released, still classified. So it was a challenge, technically, you know, for practical reasons. As a writer, you want to take a topic that is challenging to your art, and also it's a major issue between the country and the individual betrayal, who betrays whom. But the amazing part is, in fact, I knew the guy, because at his trial, he claimed that he loved both countries. So that's the trick. He was a spy, but he said he was loyal to America. He was basically saying, China and the America like father and mother. How could I betray one against the other? So basically, I realized there was a deep emotional entanglement, the complexity. The man was somehow really traumatized too by this. But I was surprised when the book came out. It was often used or taught as a kind of immigrant literature because this is about the divided loyalties. So for many immigrants, this was a major emotional issue. Honestly, while I was working on the book, I didn't stretch that, imagine this would be about the deep part of an immigrant's emotion. But I knew that the guy, gradually he was a spy, but somehow he began to shift to becoming an immigrant.
So just tell us a bit more. So this is a Chinese national who came to America and naturalized and was accused of spying for the Chinese government in America.
Yes.
And did the Chinese government ever confirm that?
No. They denied any connection. They said everything was fabricated by those who are hostile to China. But the truth is, the guy, he worked in CIA, and for many years later he became a major official. Because he knew both languages, all the
important documents sent to the White House and the Pentagon, he would give the final touches. And so in China, for many years, for decades, appreciated his service. He became a vice minister for national security, really very, very top official. So that's why he assumed that he made such service for both countries, to both countries. So they wouldn't, he wouldn't end in jail. But China basically did not any connection with him.
So really, truly between two worlds.
Yes.
Neither would accept it.
Yes, yes.
So Martin, and your book together, your novel together, Tea, I mean, this is probably truly a universal subject, since it's truth universally acknowledged that this is a courtship story. This is marriage. How does you know, in this case, an Iranian family find a groom for their bride? And so, you know, this is how did you find your own voice on this? Given this is such a rich and universal topic, how did you find your way into this story?
So the short answer is Excel spreadsheets. because like most immigrant children, most children of immigrants are encouraged to become a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. And in my case, I took the LSAT. I did all that. But in any case, I ended up in business school. And I was in business school, and I was in a thing called math camp for people who needed to come up to speed with calculus, and they were teaching us spreadsheets and how to use them to find the bottom line of a company. And I thought, what if you used a spreadsheet to rate a person? And then I thought, what if an Iranian mother used a spreadsheet to rate men for her daughter? So that was on my mind at the time. And so I literally wrote the first chapter of that novel during business school's math camp. And I think sometimes, you know, when we're doing something we don't want to do, writing can be such a great escape. And I liked the idea of what we call in Farsi khasegari, which is basically like matching up young people. And it's not necessarily an arranged marriage. I really think it's the old version of Match.com, where, you know, people who know your attributes talk to people who know somebody else's attributes, and they try to find a match. And I wrote the book thinking, this never happened to me, but isn't it funny to write about? And then after I was writing it, after I'd written it, I looked back at some experiences, and I was like, oh, when they invited that guy over for dinner, wait a second. And then I spoke to my parents, and they said, yeah, well, you know. So this is something that does happen in the Persian culture, and it's very subtle, where especially, you know, when you're an immigrant and you're in this world that's so alien for the parents, there is this attempt to kind of find a match that will understand you culturally. And I thought it would be fun to play with that. And I also like the idea of introducing this thing, you know, the Jane Austen, it's universally acknowledged kind of thing, that marriage plot, to then delve into some really deeper topics. It's kind of nice to start off with the Excel spreadsheets, and then you find that they lead you back to Iran and back to lots of deeper issues.
I mean, you mentioned subtlety there. I understand that when it came to the cover art, subtlety wasn't necessarily what publishers wanted. The idea of what a novel about female experience in Iran should be, there seems to be some set ideas here. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So when my novel was coming out, I had the benefit of having a very good publishing house that would listen to my kind of desires for the cover. And I'd seen so many covers of books about Iran or Iranian women where it was very gray, very dark. The women looked miserable. You know, you just looked at the cover, you wanted to cry. And I thought, well, that's not the women I know. The women I know are so strong, so opinionated, pretty darn colorful. So I told my publisher, you know, these characters would not be that way. So the cover of the book is incredibly bright. The women don't look terribly oppressed. Because you have to understand, in these societies where women are oppressed, they're still pretty outspoken. And Iranian women are very, very outspoken. And I just had to look to people in my own family, you know. So I was very grateful that I had a say in the cover. And I was very grateful that, you know, the tea on the cover, it's not a teacup. It's a tea glass. It's like, you know, the way they would drink the tea. So I think this is something, as, you know, an immigrant writer, sometimes you are sort of given these tropes. And some are appropriate, but other times it's important to speak up and to say, guess what? We're not always in black and white. We're in color.
Mm. Yeah. So, Grace, your memoir, you've got some very universal themes there as well, which is family and peeling back sort of the layers of trauma, essentially, and what's brought us to that moment. I was wondering, could you read, there was an extract you said that you could read about your father, which
sure.
was really quite stunning, if you wouldn't mind.
So this is from the opening of the book, and it's called My Father's Noose. When my father was a boy, his mother hung him. Enter Tondo, a Manila slum, and stand in the kitchen of his childhood home. Look up. The crusty knot is still there, tied around the light fixture. I imagine my father, Totoy, at 10. He hasn't graduated yet to long pants and shoes. His shorts and t-shirts are faded and soft from the wear of three older brothers. Totoy has done something to make his mother angrier than she's ever been. And now Totoy balances on a stack of vegetable crates, his neck connected to the ceiling. He's wearing one rubber slipper, and after slapping him on the ears, his mother has tucked the other slipper under the bow tie of her apron. If Totoy becomes dizzy and loses balance, or if a nun kicks the crates away, he might save himself by curling his fingers around the rope and pulling against the noose as if it were the mouth on a drawstring bag. But his mother plants his palms to his hips and looks up at him. She doesn't say a word, but Totoy hears, "Don't try to save yourself. Don't you dare." He moves only his eyes, and from this height, he notices his mother is balding. Her gray hair is loosely bunned, and there are triangles of white flesh between the comb tracks. Her body is thick and intimidating, fleshy roll layered onto fat, souvenirs from 11 pregnancies. Totoy is number 7. When she's angry, she makes noise and breaks things and stares at you until you look away. One by one, Totoy's siblings return from school and work, take a step into the kitchen, and right back out without a word. With a pestle, she pounds garlic in the mortar bowl. She raises the butcher knife to her shoulder and chops heads from fish. She'll fry the bodies for dinner and save the heads and tails for soup the next day. What does Totoy think as he stands there watching his mother prepare dinner? Does he believe he will taste that dinner? Perhaps his mother will remove the crate and watch him suffocate and kick until the knot is as tight as it will go, allow his siblings to play tetherball with his body, or keep him tied there, hanging from the kitchen. His siblings are hiding, staying far away from the kitchen. Even if his father could be found, perhaps he is playing pool in a neighborhood bar, or perhaps he is earning money by taking a passenger from the market to their home on the sidecar of his tricycle, Totoy's father wouldn't save him. Mother knows best, and she tells him, "I'm doing this because you're my son. You need to learn right from wrong." Totoy doesn't know this yet. He will survive. 15 years later, he will have me, a daughter, but he will never forgive his mother, and half a century later, he won't attend her funeral. Totoy will try his best not to abuse his children, but he's his mother's son. He will.
Thank you. So So, Grace, could you talk a bit about your pathway into writing, how you came to this?
Sure. I mean, one of my earliest memories in the United States is writing. I remember because I got in trouble. I had written on my sister's report card. She was in the first grade, and I had written a story all over it with pictures too. I wasn't in school yet, and so I remember that moment because that's, I think, one of the first moments I started writing. But I was lonely as a kid. I think one of the things about coming to this country is that we were alone. We lived in a compound in the Philippines with, my parents had 7 siblings each. We had lots of family and helpers all around us, and we lived together in community. And we came here to Boston, and we lived in an apartment, and it was winter, and it was cold, and we didn't know anybody. I was lonely, and so I made up stories. And then when I was finally able to read, it was very important for me to go to the library. I went every week and got a big old stack of books and read them, and it was this other world or this other home to go to and other people's stories. And at some point, I wrote stories for fun during the summers and on my own, and I didn't know it was something I could do because no one in literature looked like me. I didn't discover. I mean, I saw like little bits. I saw caricatures of Chinese people and Asian people in literature, but I never saw a book that was about an Asian American family or an Asian family until I came across Maxine Hong Kingston's *The Woman Warrior*. And at the time I was growing up, there wasn't so much available. And then I went to college and I took writing classes there, but I was Marjan, you mentioned about being a professional. I was headed towards medical school, and I did all the pre-med requirements. I was terrible, but I worked really hard and still, you know, got my B minuses. And then eventually, when I was a senior, in college, I called my parents to come to the university. And I said, I want to talk to you about something. It's really important. And now that I think about it, maybe they were really scared. Maybe they thought I had like other news. But they came to campus, and I said, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. I want to do something else. And I remember my father standing there and saying, like, that's fine. Like, why are you saying, why did you like waste gas and have me drive all the way over here for you to say that? He said, it's your life, and you should do what you want. It doesn't mean that he understands what I do, but he did. That did help a lot for him to say that. He was supposed to come today, but he had to go elsewhere. And he did ask me, like, he thinks of his relationship to work and my relationship to my work as a writer. It's very different. Like, he thought of work in increments of 15 minutes because he's a physician, and he would get paid for those like 15-minute increments. And you know, when I publish things, he'll ask me, like, oh, well, how much did you get paid for that? Like, how much per hour would that fee come out to? Like, zero, Dad, like negative money, because, you know, yeah. And then he even asked about today. He said, oh, well, how much are you getting paid? And I was like, it's an honor to come to this festival. Like, I'm getting paid and being able to talk with all of you and be here. That's really, it's not money, it's something else. But it's a different economy that he doesn't quite understand. So that's okay.
Sorry about the lack of payment. So
no, it's fine.
They're not paying me either, just for the record.
No, yeah.
One question, and I will open this up after this. One thing I really want to ask you all about is language. I mean, I'm always struck as an Englishman by the fact that, you know, Joseph Conrad, you know, really his stories came to define a certain sort of British worldview, a sort of empire, post-empire, you know, sense of foreboding. And, I mean, he was a Pole. From Poland, writing in an adopted language. And, you know, then there's Nabokov. I mean, you know, an astonishing achievement. So I was going to quickly read one thing from, I was reading this Haruki Murakami, the Japanese writer, and he, in this introduction here to a reprint of his first story, he explained that when he tried to write in Japanese, that it came out, you know, he was very frustrated with what he was achieving. And so he took the dramatic step of writing in English, even though he said his English was very rudimentary. So he says here, since I was born and raised in Japan, the vocabulary and patterns of the Japanese language had filled the system that was me to bursting, like a barn crammed with livestock. When I sought to put my thoughts and feelings into words, those animals began to mill about and the system crashed. Writing in a foreign language, with all the limitations it entailed, removed this obstacle. It also led me to discover that I could express my thoughts and feelings with a limited set of words and grammatical structures as long as I combine them effectively and link them together in a skillful manner. And I just thought, and then he went back to then write the novel in Japanese, but it had sort of somehow broken the patterns or the software, as it were, that allowed him to then, and if anyone's ever read his work, I mean, it's remarkably sort of simple yet affecting, and so it almost feels like you're reading English, almost feel like it was written in English or it's been translated from another language. It's quite extraordinary. So I guess, and Hayden, you've actually written essays on this topic itself, I believe, about the idea. So
yes.
could you share some of those thoughts with us?
I met, in fact, in Murakami. His English was fine, I remember. he translated many, many American authors from Fitzgerald to Carver. And so he really knows English well. But I think what he described is quite a common practice, especially among poets, where often you write in another language so that you can draft in another language, then you rewrite those, try to finish the poems in English or in another language. That's a way to make the idiom, the rhythm, the language, the target language slightly different, fresh and unusual. And that was, for instance, John Ashbery, he wrote some of his poems in French first, and then he would rewrite them. This is so complicated. In a way, this is also related to what Marjorie just read, and the hyphen. So a writer from my situation, also many immigrants, exiles, and who write in an adopted language. And then basically you try to work in the space between two or three languages. As Conrad and Nabokov, they all stay in that space. But from the very beginning, I raised a question to myself. There must have been hundreds of writers writing in English at the time. Why only Conrad and Nabokov survived? And my answer to that was they were great stylists, absolutely original. They have a very original style. Conrad is different. You know, he also knew French well, but in his language, you can see there's a strong sense of the language is confined by dictionaries. Basically, he does not wander outside of the vocabulary, but his syntax is foreign. The sentence has a very distinct Polish kind, you know, European kind of foreign structures. And so that will give him a very different style, elegant, very complicated, some elaborate. Whereas in the case of Nabokov, he wanted the opposite, the other way. But he was humorous, playful, joking constantly. He made a great breakthrough, that is to use the defects, mistakes, fragments, mispronunciations, all these things immigrants and exiles experienced. He used these elements to make jokes, to create humor. So I think that is a great example. For me, that is a great lesson, but that is not to write. For me, don't try hard to write standard idiom, because that would be very, very bland, right? Because ultimately, a writer is defined by what you can bring, you can contribute to the language you use. So I think Nabokov is extremely valuable, important to me. But of course, I don't have the ability, I can't write like him. But for me, ideally, I would try, I have the vision to write in a kind of English that is somehow foreign, but at the same time, entirely natural. But whether I can achieve or have achieved it, I don't know. But that is my vision.
I'm just curious, and if you chose to write in Chinese, would you express yourself differently? Would it be freeing or confining or perplexing? I mean, have you tried that? Or?
Yeah, that's very different. You see, when I speak Chinese nowadays, very often I can some lot of idioms, I and they sound strange to others.
But when on, once on paper, I'm still, I feel I have a complete command of the language. For instance, in my next poetry book, all the poems were written in Chinese. I did the same as Ashbery did. I wrote the poems in Chinese drafts, and I thought then I would rewrite them in English to make the language somehow different. Mm-hmm. But in the process of writing those poems in Chinese, I realized that really I'm still good at doing this. These should be finished poems. So I decided to just finish these poems first. So I basically, in recent years, I published two books of poems in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And then I rewrote the poems. I kind of translated them. Mm-hmm. So I just rewrote some of them, not everyone. A lot of poems would not make sense because they are entrenched in the culture and
in the character,
everything.
Yeah,
yes,
of course.
But I rewrote some of the poems in English. So now I have a book forthcoming from Copper Canyon in the spring. Mm. So that basically. A writer for our situation, we just follow our instinct. We don't know in the beginning, we don't know whether you can can finish a project, how far you can go, we don't know. But once you enter into the territory, you have to just follow your instinct.
Mm. Martin, do you anything you want to say on that yeah. very rich topic?
All I want to add is I think that's so true. And technically, English is my second language because it's the second language I learned, not the first. But I feel stronger in English now. But I think knowing Persian so well helps my writing. Because sometimes people will say, I love how you described that. That's such a creative way. And I'm like, oh, that's just how we say it in Persian. But, there are things that you carry within you that you're not even aware of. And you have all these metaphors and similes. You have really like another way of looking at the world. And I do notice sometimes with syntax, like I'll use a different kind of syntax. My husband calls it Yoda-ish sentences, where I'll switch the normal sort of order of things, but other people think that's a style. So I think it does enrich you, and it gives you it's almost like you have access to this entire other planet and this other way of looking at the world.
Mm. Grace, you said that you, even in the Philippines, you were speaking a mixture of English and Tagalog at home.
Well, the language I was exposed to from 0 to 3 was Tagalog. I mean, I had a 24-hour day caregiver, and she communicated to me in Tagalog. My parents speak Tagalog. But when we came to this country, they made an effort, or they decided, you're not going to speak Tagalog. You're only going to speak English. We don't want you to have problems with discrimination or other things if you have an accent or if you're not learning English. And so I only learned English growing up. But I feel like there's this lost language in my head. I can't access it. I can sort of understand what people are saying. But really all I have is a feeling when I hear Tagalog. And it's a very warm feeling. Like I feel friendly and intimate with that person, even if they're a stranger to me. There's something about the sound of that language that makes me feel like it's home of some sort.
Hmm. So the language is almost speaking to you sort of below the level of rational. It's sort of coming in another frequency.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, let's open this up to questions. I'm sure many people here have got things they want to add. There's a microphone at the front here. I think that's the only one. Is that right? Yes. So please come to the front and ask a question of anyone in particular. And as long as it ends with a question and, keep... And so we have enough time for as many people as possible. So please share.
Yeah, thank you very much. Very interesting. Your discussion about language recalled to mind that I just read last year a biography of Pearl Buck, who, as you know, wrote The Good Earth. And she was an American, she was the daughter of American missionaries in China. But she was raised by her housekeeper, who was Chinese. Her first language was actually Chinese. And according to the biographer, when she wrote The Good Earth, she actually conceived of it in Chinese mentally first, and then wrote it in English, which I found quite astonishing. But my question is, any comments on that? And do you know of anybody who has replicated that kind of experience in their writing?
I think that was true. In fact, when I remember when I was reading The Good Earth, I recognized a lot of Chinese idioms. For instance, she would call an engine or locomotive fire wagon. That's an exact transcription of right, the Chinese idiom. Mm. And there's also this kind of earthy quality in that prose. I think she was a very extraordinary, different case because she grew up in China. Her nannies were Chinese. Chinese, in a way, was her first language. And currently, there are a few. I think there was a British woman in China, also some another person, woman from the West, are writing in Chinese. But not novels, smaller stories, smaller pieces. I think there's one from Latin America somewhere, a woman. They have already caught attention of the media, but they're still young. This is a matter, another matter I would say, that's the matter of survival. Once you use a language, it's not just for fun, really. Look at the case of Conrad Nabokov. Conrad, in his 12th year, I remember he had a conversation with his friend. He said, during the past 11 years, I've written 12 books, but I don't remember 15 minutes diversion. That kind of intensity, intense labor, unimaginable. Even Nabokov was such a great, a genius, supremely talented. Several times he was shipped from his office to the hospital because of exhaustion. He worked so hard.
Compulsive.
Very hard. Compulsive, yeah. Yes, compulsive. Yeah. Huh. So that's why I said it's a language of survival. Unless you have to do it, don't do it. Always stay with your first language. I think that is my advice to my students, to young writers, always stay with your first language.
Advice that you yourself didn't follow.
Okay. Thank you all very much. So a lot of immigrant stories are superficially mundane, but hide a certain heroic component behind them. My parents' own story, for example, they came to this country, timed their arrival at 7 in the morning so that they'd have the whole day to figure out where we were going to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. Kind of a mundane story, but with a heroic thing. So as writers, how do you communicate to a reader who doesn't have that experience that some of these stories are mundane, but they are heroic, and how do you deal with that?
So the quotidian stories, and do you sort of sketch out the whole context, or do you sort of want the reader to go with you and just put themselves in that place in a way?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. How do you deal with that?
So, I mean, I'm constantly observing what's going on and observing life, and I think the story that you told is quite heroic. I don't think it's mundane at all. It's extraordinary to think that they arrived. They timed their arrival so they could figure out a place to stay. It shows such faith in their ability to find that place by the end of the day, right? So that to me is really interesting. But I think for me as a writer, I'm just always noticing to see what causes a spark in me, like a spark of interest, that there might be a story behind there. And I guess I don't think in terms of mundane or extraordinary. I just try to like find moments that are alive and go with that.
Yeah, obviously, I didn't think it was mundane, but, you know,
okay.
It could be interpreted that way.
Oh, okay.
I think on the page it might be. I think that's the point. Marjan, did you come across this as well?
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I remember I wanted to educate. And I thought, you know, people think Iran is this, this, and this, and it isn't, and I'm going to show them. And, you know, and then I learned that as a writer, that's not my job at all. And once I stopped trying to educate, and I kind of wrote to the highest intelligent reader I could, that helped. And I think it helps to be specific. You know, like I think as writers we make a mistake when we try to draw with a broad brush. So for me, I know with my characters, I was like, I'll just tell you how this girl feels during recess on her first day in America. And it has to do with what she's eating that day. And that specificity helps people, I think, find that kind of universal emotion that makes it heroic and not mundane.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It was interesting. I just reread The Good Earth, so it was interesting to hear your take on it. But the question that I had is, when do you bump into just experiences or concepts or that sort of thing that you feel you really can't get across? And you know, is that frustrating to you, or do you just let it go? Do you just think, you know what, people aren't going to understand unless they're in it?
You mean, so the question is, the experiences here in America as immigrants, and that people would, unless you've come from that particular country and come this on this pathway, mm-hmm. it wouldn't make sense otherwise.
Right, or just, you know, when you're trying to, I guess, when you're trying to get across an experience that you've had, and you just have a hard time finding words for it, and you realize that it really is just so unique to your own experience mm-hmm. that you can't, you just can't convey it, you know, or maybe it's a translation issue. Like maybe there's a, you know, in Persian you might say something and there's just no way to access it to make readers who aren't Persian get it.
Yeah, I mean, my instinct when you asked that question, when you said when, I felt like saying every day because sometimes when I watch the news, it just feels like Groundhog's Day. As an Iranian-American, I'm like, okay, so this is how people thought it was 30 years ago, and it's still, I'm still saying the same things, like, no, it's not like that. It's not like that over there. And after a while, it gets exhausting. But in the writing of it, again, I think for me, it was very liberating to realize that I wasn't there to educate anybody. And people have access to encyclopedias, I should say Wikipedia, I guess, and people have access to books and history books and Google, and to just focus on the lives of these characters. But I reconciled within myself a long, long time ago that there is a huge segment of this planet that will never understand Iran, for lack of a better word, and I just have accepted that. And I think Iranians probably don't even understand it. So I've stopped trying. I think when I was young, I would try really hard, and now it's just like, you know, I'll do what I can with these characters, and that's really all I can do.
I mean, to me, this is the work of being a writer and trying to translate that experience, like something that's hard to translate in writing. That's the challenge for me, is to try to get whatever that thing is across, and that's interesting to try to do that. And the more specific, I agree with you, Marjan, about specificity is the way to get at that experience. It somehow becomes universal the more specific you are. It doesn't sound right, but I feel that happens.
I mean, Hajin, for you, you know, in many cases, you have to, you know, once you bring in any aspects of Chinese society and politics, you sort of, you know, have to explain why the vice minister of so-and-so would be in the position of power to do whatever, because there's a whole sort of apparatus that isn't so apparent here. I mean, you deal with that in your books.
I want to answer this question in combination with the gentleman's question, the previous question. I think that this is related to the personal sensibility. I don't care about, you know, whether I should represent China or another culture. That's not my business. I'm a writer. I want to write a story. I'm responsible only for the work and for the characters. So what to be expressed is my own business as an artist. It's my artistic decision. A lot of details to some people might be trivial, but to really other kind of people be very important. For instance, one of my characters in my novel, Free Life, he had a fight with his wife, a quarrel with his wife. He went to the supermarket, and then the supermarket in the morning was serving free coffee and pastry. He picked a piece of muffin and a cup of coffee, he suddenly he felt happy. A lot of Chinese readers, they said he was so trivial. But for a common immigrant, you sweat for every dollar. That would make a big difference. But for an artist, for me, for a writer, my sensibility, you know, for me, I have to decide, you know, this is more authentic, more meaningful. Even artistic, it's more convincing than, you know, any kind of prettified kind of details. So that so very often it's largely depends on the writer's sensibility. You know, especially, I think a good writer should have the eyes to catch the details, revealing, telling details. Very often that's a mark of a talent, I think. And also, as for loss, I think it's basically unavoidable. It's a part of it. Any language has its limitation. For instance, in Chinese, there are so many words about feelings, right? All kind of emotions, shade after shade of emotions. In English, they don't have that kind of words. About food, the taste, right? Ma, right? How can you use a lot of words? Su, you know, xuan, how can you can't? There are no words for these kind of taste at all. But on the other hand, so for me, that is not important. Important because a good piece of work, especially you write literature, it's really, you should operate on the principle of similarity and identity. For me, that is more important. Because at core, you want to speak something that is universal, that would relate, resonate to everyone. So for me, to write in another language, basically, for me, it's more important to be alert about to what can be gained from that. A good example, again, a lesson from Nabokov in the novel Punin. The narrator used in the narration would say, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, right? That's a foreigner's eye, foreign eye. Suddenly, you can, a guy will got excited by a very common, plain feature of the language. So for me, that is an example to learn how to, you know, to play, to basically try to gain from this transition. Another example, Punin gave a summary of his vita, and then the narrator said it's curriculum vita in a nutshell, then dash coconut shell. You can see very for native speaker just the coconut, just a nutshell, but for foreigner he plays with it. He highlights his foreignness, and suddenly you have as if a child's eye, you know, for first time was the child was amazed. But it's a very common feature in the language. So for me, it's more important to try hard to gain from this process.
Mm. As Pablo Picasso said, he spent his adult life trying to remember and learn how to paint again like a child without the sort of filters and oh, no, you don't do this, you do that. I was going to ask you, the trope of American literature is, you know, you can never go home again, and home is a... Home is a big part of the American experience, a big part of American literature. People, the Americans make home in many ways. I'm just wondering, the exile's journey. I mean, this is also part of it for yourselves and for immigrant writers. I mean, what is home? How do you find and define home?
Well, for a lot of my growing up, I grew up in a homogeneous town, and so there were very few Asian Americans. We were one of two Filipino families in town, so I had this idea that the Philippines was home, and my parents would call it home. They said, oh, the people back home, or, you know, I talked to my mother at home, or they would reference the Philippines as home. And so I had this idea that it was home, and then when I finally returned, once we had our papers sorted out, I returned when I was in college, and as soon as I got off the plane, I just thought, no, this is not my home. This is not home for me. This doesn't feel like home. But I kept wanting it to feel like home. And so even a couple of years ago, I was drawn to go move to the Philippines, and I got a Fulbright and lived there for 6 months. And I kept wanting it to feel like home, and it didn't. I don't... I tried to fit in. I would like try to pretend to be Filipino and use the language and get around that way, but they knew immediately that I was American. I don't know what it was, but they was like, "You're American," and then so it's different.
But as a writer, sort of that tension gives you something to explore, of course.
Absolutely. Know, I mean, that's exactly where the interesting moments for me to explore as a writer are in moments of confusion. I have lots of questions. I'm, you know, in pain about something. I don't understand something, and I write my way through it and try to discover what is it am I thinking or feeling, and it's through the process of writing.
And Hajin, I believe you can't go home again.
Yeah, but I've been thinking. Try many. I've been here for 32 years. I never returned to China because of politics. But I've been thinking a lot about this. In fact, the word homeland, for instance, has two meanings. Originally, it's about it is your native place, but now it has different meaning. So we have homeland security. Right, that means where your home is. Right, you know. Often people say my adopted homeland. That means home can be built. I think that's very important. This is related to the idea of arrival rather than return. So for me, in fact, we really shouldn't make too much of this because I realized I think displacement is common among human beings. Maybe it's part of our growth, our development. Everybody somehow, at one point, you have to leave home, right? And your hometown, in fact, was your parents' or your grandparents' foreign town, right? So everybody somehow was taken away from your original place. That's okay. But what was painful or really tragic is the interruption between the past and the present in a person's life. So very often intensifies the nostalgia. Yeah. By the way, on the other hand, in order to live decently, to continue, you have to be rational about this. Yeah. That's why I said displacement is a common human situation.
Mm-hmm. Marjan, can you go home again?
Well, I've been back to Iran again, but it's definitely not home. And honestly, like I said at the beginning, I feel home isn't even a place. I think home is in maybe things you do or the people you're with. So my family's home, writing is home, reading is home, certain foods are home. But I don't know if Massachusetts is home or Iran is home. When I go to Iran, it's the same thing, Grace. Immediately, like just from the way I stand, oh, American. So I'm like, I finally look like all of you, but they still can tell. And I think maybe home is overrated. We're so stuck on, oh, home, home. And if you think about it, it helped when my daughter was studying world history. Human beings, for the most part, were nomadic. It was only since the agricultural sort of, you know, situation where we suddenly were planted in one place. So sometimes I think we were meant to move. We were meant to just be displaced. It helps sometimes, on some days. So I just think of it as things I do or people I'm with, but not a place.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a good note to end it on for a panel like this, that home is essentially not a place, and it's you can discover it and shape it and mold it, and it can be inspiring for literature as well. So I'd like to thank all of my guests for coming, for my panel. Thank you, everyone, for coming here. Thank you.